You're listening to 89.1 KMUW. Listeners might not recognize Carrie Rawson by name until they hear the title of her book, A Serial Killer's Daughter. KMUW's Tom Shine and Beth Golay recently spoke with Rawson about her journey since learning her father was the BTK serial killer.
After the identity of BTK was discovered and news organizations realized you were his daughter, you were asked to appear on a lot of shows, Oprah, Larry King, and you wrote in the book, I Told Everyone No, So Did Mom, A United Front of Solidarity. Are your mom and Brian okay with this book?
It's been a process for all of us. We had that family code of we don't speak to the media, and we had that code for almost 10 years. And then I broke the code and exploded to the Wichita Eagle in the fall of 14. I literally was like, my mouth was flying on the telephone. I was like front page news the next morning. You know, I had to call my mom that night before it ran. And I was like, so I just interviewed with the Wichita Eagle. That was a pretty awkward conversation. Most of my family's still in Kansas, so they sort of have to just brace for impact when I decided to do something, but they've adjusted. So, I mean, it's been 4 years since that large piece ran in the Eagle on forgiveness and my larger story. They've gotten used to me doing this. And, you know, I let them know very early I was thinking of writing. And actually out of that came some really good conversations with my mom in the summer of 15. I was actually back in therapy after I did that large piece. I went back for 6 months to trauma therapy, which you don't see in the book. Actually, I took the Wichita Eagles book in about BTK, and we went sentence by sentence just so I could process and finally deal with what my father had done. Out of me, you know, sort of opening my mouth came some pretty good conversations with my mom, and I grew closer to her. So she's been super supportive, quietly in the way my mom is. My mom's even read the book already.
So do you think your mom and Brian, do you think they want to still keep their silence?
Yeah, I mean, it's harder really, honestly, for people that live back there because, you know, they're living in these communities. They're trying to maintain the lives they always have had. They want to be able to have their privacy to go to the grocery store or go to church or work. So I'm protected from that living in Michigan and Detroit in like in a city of 4 million. Nobody knows who we are. I mean, I feel like everybody has the right to talk or not talk and heal the way they want to. And, you know, my family's decided to stay quiet, and I'm not as completely their right. But I feel like they're proud of what I've done and, you know, supportive of me.
So why did you decide to write this book?
I decided to write the book after speaking up in the media. So in February 15, you know, that large piece ran about my life, and I talked about what I had been through, and I talked about forgiveness and, you know, my own struggles with mental health and PTSD. And right after that, people started writing into the newspaper and writing me, letting me know that something positive was resonating in my story in their life. Something I was saying was helping them with their own trauma or as being like, you know, an abuse or trauma survivor. So when I saw that like something good, positive could come out of all of this horribleness that my father had created, and it was helping me, to talk. It was sort of like healing on flash forward, you know, forcing myself to have to talk to the media, forcing myself to have to walk into these newsrooms and look people in the eye and shake their hand and, you know, basically say, you know, I'm Dennis Rader's daughter. That was healing to me. It was that really hard, like I'm shaking healing, but it was cathartic to have to talk and start working with the media. And so writing was the same thing. I mean, it forced me to have to go back and sit and find my father again, which I needed to do. And it forced me to deal with everything I had been through. I mean, my trauma therapist kept saying, you need to go write. And I wouldn't do it. I like refused. And then I spent 3.5 years writing because once I started, I couldn't stop. It just all sort of came out on the page.
You had night terrors as a child, and you sought help for depression in college, and you suffered through postpartum depression after your first child. So I think it's safe to say that your mental state was somewhat fragile before you even learned the truth about your dad. You mentioned going to trauma therapy. You mentioned writing. How do you think you were able to work through this with having that fragile state?
I mean, I never knew as a child I was fragile. I thought I was pretty strong and tough. You know, tomboy, my dad raised me to be pretty tough. I mean, I had these night terrors, but from my neuro understanding, like, kids had them and I would grow out of them. I mean, back in the 80s, you didn't really seek help for children in therapy like you would now. So, you know, as far as we know, they could be trauma-based PTSD, or it could be a sleep disorder. I still don't even know. So I didn't realize, like, that, you know, I knew my father had some struggles, minor struggles, but of course I didn't know, you know, that, like, the mental illness my father has, you know, and I wasn't aware, like, that depression and anxiety sort of run through my father's line genetically. So now I'm here in college, I'm suffering, I'm not telling my family, I'm not aware of any issues in my family to be aware of. You know, I sort of just brooded my way through college. It really wasn't until 2 years after my father's arrest that I got to the right kind of help. And that's when she said, you know, she put names to these things I had been struggling with, you know, for a long time. I mean, without trauma therapy, I wouldn't probably still be alive.
And how are you now?
I'm pretty good. I mean, I live with depression and I live with anxiety. I think the anxiety is more day to day. Like, I'll have seasons of depression. Last year, the depression was bad because I was stuck in writing and I had to get several extensions because of the PTSD. I would hit things I wouldn't want to write. Also, my son was quite ill last year, missed most of first grade. He's doing much better now. But so I was trying to take care of him and write. So the depression right now isn't, you know, an issue, but the anxiety I sort of just live with day to day, and the PTSD can just flare up whenever. It's pretty much the worst of the brutes because it can just come out of nowhere and hit you like a ton of bricks. And I still have night terrors. That's what I have.
Your, you know, Tom and I were both talking about this earlier. Your husband, Darian, really comes across as a hero and your rock in this book. You told a story about the inscription on your wedding bands. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah. So with my wedding bands, we purchased my engagement ring in Manhattan, Kansas. But we got him inscribed in Wichita where we were getting married. And he handed it to me the day we were decorating the church a couple of days before we were getting married. Inside of it, it says, "Love never fails," but they left the R off the never. So it's N-E-V-E. And his is correct. They got the R on his. So normally, like, you would have taken it back and asked him to, you know, fix it. But we were moving to Michigan a few days after getting married. We didn't have time. I was just like, it's fine. I'll leave it. So my wedding ring still has that inscription with the missing R.
So you never got it repaired?
I never did. It's very unique. So when we got married, then we had, you know, 1 Corinthians 13 read over us about love never fails. You know, like, everything else can fall away, but love will never fail. And that verse was on a stained glass picture in my kitchen on the day the FBI agent came. And I remember actually just brushing my hand against it. So, sometimes you don't see these themes in your life until you start writing. And you sort of latch on to them and you don't want to let them go. So I even shared a different version of 1 Corinthians 13 at the beginning of part 3 about when everything else falls away. Some of that stuff I didn't even find until I wrote. It was important to me to show love throughout this book and show hope and show light, because it's so much darkness that, you know, that was one of the things I clung to. Even as I was writing, I would come upon these things and they would lift my spirit and keep me going. Writing was like the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. And it took like 3.5 years to do it.
You've written your father quite often in prison, and he's written you. But I don't think, according to the book, you've visited your father yet in prison. Do you think you'll ever visit him in prison?
I don't know. I've never visited him. I mean, it's complicated because first you have to call and be put on a list. You have to be vetted. And then to go in, I mean, he's in a maximum security wing. So they have to be aware that you're coming and be prepared. Then, like, they have to weave you through the building. And as far as I understand, you're in one room talking through a video monitor, and he's in another room shackled to a table. So from my understanding, the audio's not very good. The video's not very good. So I've been told it would actually be better to have him call me because, like, I heard he can't even really even hear you well over the video. So people, you know, people go over like, well, you forgive your dad, and you love your dad, but you won't go visit. And it's not as simple as just walking into a prison and sitting across the table from somebody. Like, I'll never get to hug my dad again. I'll never get to touch my dad again. And that's on my dad because he lost all that 45 years ago when he stepped into the Otero home. But it's not as simple as people think it is, you know. And to have my dad call me, like, what do I do now? Do I give him my phone number? I don't want my dad to have my phone number. I don't want my dad to have my address. We protect those things. So when he mails me, he mails to a location in Wichita, and then my family sends it on to me because we can't trust my father and we can't trust who he communicates with. And, you know, I have a family to protect also.
What if at some point in the future, as your children get older and become young adults, and they want to establish a relationship with your father by letter, by visiting him, what would you counsel them?
So, I mean, at this point, they're 10 and 7. They know that their grandpa's in prison and won't be getting out. At this point, they know that he's harmed people. But we try to protect them, like, from the words murder and my dad's BTK acronym. I mean, we're trying to just walk them up so that they're not shocked or Googling mom and surprised when they get older. But we're also trying to protect them as children. I mean, later on, if they wanted to write him, you know, I think I would walk through that process with them, or if they wanted to visit. I mean, I honestly don't imagine that they would because they don't have a connection to him. They don't know him. You know, he's just a stranger to them. I mean, they've seen a few pictures and they know I wrote. They saw me for years writing, but they've also seen me suffer quite a bit, and they know a lot of it's due to my father. So to them, I don't think it was somebody they would ever really connect to. You know, like, they adore their other grandpa. They honestly even just call my dad, like, Dennis or your dad. Like, they don't ever refer to him as grandpa.
You mentioned memories several times in the book. At one point you wrote, "It's odd the things one remembers." And also you wrote, "I have my memories and now I know the truth." Do memories surprise you still?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was so new to writing. I honestly had to look up the word memoir and, like, what does that mean? Like, someone said, like, I think you're going to go write a memoir. I was like, what does that mean? What does it mean to write a memoir? Like, to write from memory. It's crazy how your memory, like, when something like the worst moment of your life in 2005, when you're being notified your dad's BTK, like, I can tell you the color of my purse and where my keys were sitting and, you know, the cake sitting on the counter and what was on the wall. I don't think I could tell you what I had for lunch yesterday. You know, it's these, some things, like, just sort of seal tight even in these worst moments. Like, there's things you can remember, but I can't tell you the name of the FBI agent. You know, like, I don't have that in my memory. Mm-hmm. And memory is funny. It would frustrate you because you're trying to write about something and you're sitting in it for so long that you can recall things if you really focus. But then some things you'll never be able to bring back. And then some, you're in it for so long, you start questioning yourself and you feel like you got to fact check yourself, you know. And so then you do go back to letters and you go back to, say, like, a journal, or you call somebody and say, like, did this actually happen? You know, or you're trying to research your own life, or you're trying to research your dad's life. So you're relying on other sources. For example, the Eagle book, because, like, I had to go back somewhere, you know, because I wasn't even alive for 7 of the murders. So I had to rely on a different source there. I obviously wouldn't have any memories of the 70s.
You wrote about the victims of your dad's crimes. There were 10 people who were murdered. The victims were also their families, your family. At one point in the book, you wrote about betrayal and how your dad had betrayed the whole city. You know, we don't really know the far-reaching effects of his actions. You say he has asked God for forgiveness. When asking for forgiveness, do you think he realizes the number of people he betrayed?
Like in September 05, I shared the letter where he wrote that he had asked God to be between him and the victims, and he was sorry. But that's about the only time I've really ever seen remorse from my father. And I legit don't know if it was for real. I don't think he understands the ramifications of what he's done. I mean, I think when he thinks of the victims, I would hope he would at least think of the 10 people's lives he took and their families that he forever impacted. But I don't think he understands the generational cost of what he's done. I mean, he took children's lives who could have grown up and had families. You know, he took parents away from children. He took daughters away, you know, from their families. He took sisters away. So he took away a lot of young people that had their whole lives in front of them. Then by taking away people's mothers, you know, in front of children, like those children were severely impacted. Their whole life was altered. I mean, if you think of like that spreading out, like now there's the generation of loss of a family. So, I mean, how many hundreds or thousands of people have my father negatively impacted? You know, I mean, he imploded my family. My family's never been the same. You know, we're trying the best that we can, but it doesn't always look very pretty. I mean, I would do anything to wipe it all out, go back in time, you know, send him to a psychiatric hospital before he committed the Otero murders, and then 10 people would have their lives back. But, you know, I wrote in the book, then that would mean I wouldn't be alive. So then my kids wouldn't be alive. So, you know, I'm getting emotional right now talking about it because, like, that's not an easy place to sit and come to that realization, you know, that this person that you carry his blood around that committed so much travesty for 31 years to all these people in the community. You know, and you almost felt like in 05 you were playing catch up. Like it wasn't until 04 that I even had heard of BTK. Like in 04, I was trying to figure out what had happened in Wichita and who was, you know, I didn't even know about any of this. You know, and now all of a sudden in 05, it's your father and every day for the rest of your life is altered.
Your book is a journey of your path to forgiveness for your father. And coming to terms with all this. You write about your father and forgiveness, that even though most people look at me skeptically, my father will be in heaven someday if he has accepted Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for everyone, including him. A lot of people who don't have your faith will have a tough time thinking of Dennis Rader being in heaven. How would you talk to those people?
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting hit for it, like, you know, I'm getting hit on social media right now. People are, you know, questioning me about it or being downright nasty about it. You know, I mean, like I got a message today, your dad's a monster. You don't have the right to be talking or doing anything you're doing. From a Christianity standpoint, our faith says if you ask God for forgiveness and you accept Jesus Christ, his son, as your savior, all your sins are forgiven. They're wiped clean. As far as like east is from west, that's in Psalms, I believe, or Isaiah, you know, and you will be in heaven. So I don't know if my father has had that reckoning moment with God. I don't know if he accepts Christ. I definitely do not believe my father was a Christian before 05. I know he was pretty severely affected after the arrest, as he should have been. It's my hope that maybe in that first month or so that he did come to Christ, but based on his behavior since then, off and on, I, you know, like normally if somebody's a Christian, like, of course they're going to screw up, but normally you would see a change of heart or good works. And obviously we're not seeing that from my father. So, I mean, it's my hope that he's accepted Christ and he'll be home with me and be new, but I have no idea till I get there myself. So I mean, some people are saying, well, she means her father, not like BTK, but I mean, God can forgive anybody.
You mentioned earlier when you broke your silence and reached out to the Eagle, when you were angry, when Stephen King announced that one of his short stories based on your dad was being made into a movie. You were quoted in the Eagle saying, any money King makes off this story should go either to abused children, battered wives, or police. Some people are saying the same thing about you with this book. Do you have similar plans for the proceeds of this book?
This book is my story. Like, I understand I don't have the story if my dad hadn't done what he did. But I'm also an abuse victim and a crime victim and a trauma victim. So, I've never worked full time since 2005. I've spent an immense amount of money in therapy. I mean, my bottom line is I have the right to write the story, you know, and I have the right to, you know, to be paid for the work that I've done. It's a job. I worked for 3.5 years, you know, 40, 60 hours a week writing. And honestly, I think people have this misconception that writers get paid a ton. We don't. There's this misconception that because I'm working in the media, I'm getting paid. You don't get paid for any interviews. Like, I'm not being paid for any of the appearances I'm making. I'm not being paid to speak to you today. Like, that's unethical. Journalism doesn't pay for interviews. So my bottom line is I've suffered and it's my story and I have the right to tell it.
Has writing this book fulfilled what you hoped it would?
It's early. Like, it's only been out a few weeks and it's been really insane few weeks for me. I mean, it helped me. It helped get rid of those shards of glass that were stuck in me. You know, I would come up against them. I wouldn't want to write. And I had to force myself to go do it. You know, there was a lot more trauma in there from 2005 I didn't realize I hadn't worked in therapy with. A lot more PTSD than I realized. So the process itself was very cathartic. It was extremely difficult, but it helped heal me. Like, we need to talk. Like, we don't want to talk. And as soon as we do, it's like a hydrant that's exploded and you basically can't shut us up now. Like, me just telling my story over and over again is helping me. And I mean, I literally have an inbox full of positive messages of people that are being positively impacted. That's something I'm sharing is helping them with their own, you know, as an abuse survivor, trauma survivor, PTSD, war veteran, you know, I'm impacting their faith. I'm making them think. I mean, overall, the response I'm getting is positive, and, you know, I'm just trying to do some good because my dad committed so much harm for 30 years. It's my turn now to try to do at least 30 years of good. So I'm trying to remove the stigma from being a family of a criminal, but I'm also trying to remove the stigma from mental illness and saying, like, we need to start talking about these things we're all suffering from, and we need to go get help before we have another casualty.
For KMUW News, I'm Tom Schein.
And I'm Beth Golay.